Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I am joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm very, very tired.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
Movies and slaps. First up in controversies and non-controversies is the moment from this weekend's Oscars that will live on in our memories forever. I mean, a real... Where were you when you saw it moment? You know what I speak, of course. I'm talking about Zack Snyder sweeping the Fan Choice Awards, winning both fan favorite movie and the stand up and cheer moment for his thrilling depiction of the Flash entering the Speed Force in Zack Snyder's Justice League. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Just checking my notes here. Zack Snyder dominating the Oscars is a complete controversy. So not good for this segment then. So there's really just not much to discuss in that regard. Let's see. What else happened?
Will Smith's hand entered the Speed Force.
What else?
Against
what else
Chris Rock's face.
Are we gonna? We want to talk about that last duel joke? Is that the controversies and non-controversies? Do we want to talk about the we don't talk about Bruno performance and how it was terrible and not at all like the song that everybody just wanted to hear, or maybe that every award was pretty predictable more or less? Do we want to talk about the relegation of Dune to the pre-tape segments at the beginning of the show? Or is there something am I missing something? Right. It's not every day that you see a grown man open hand slap another grown man before bellowing obscenities at him in front of tens of millions of people around the world. But that's what we were treated to on Sunday when Will Smith, infuriated about a joke Chris Rock told about his wife, Jada Pinkett Smith, stepped up out of his front row seat, strode onto the stage, and just smacked Rock right in the face. It was shocking, and all the more shocking because American audiences neither saw nor heard what was happening. ABC dumped both the audio and the video of the slap and the shout, and American audiences were kind of like, what is happening? Is this a bit? What's going on? We only really saw what happened thanks to the uncut streams that people were tweeting from Australia and Japan. The sequence of events here, the uncut, uncensored sequence of events here is, I think, pretty instructive and worth breaking down moment by moment, right? So Rock jokes that Jada Pinkett Smith looks like she was prepping for G.I. Jane 2, which is a reference to her head. At first, Will Smith is laughing. Jada notably is not. Camera catches her with a bit of a scowl on her face. The camera then cuts back to Rock and he goes on, and then we hear him say something, and then suddenly Smith is just striding across the stage and he slaps him and he strides back to his seat, where he proceeds to shout, keep my wife's name out of your effing mouth, twice at Rock, at the top of his lungs, very loud. Everybody could hear it. Now, playing armchair psychiatrist is tricky. No one should do it, but I'm going to take a shot here. In his recent memoir, Smith has a whole chapter where he talks about having to learn how to do less to please people around him and more to care for his own mental state, how to basically stop being the people-pleasing Will Smith that he had trained himself to be for 20 straight years and get into a little more personal headspace. You can actually see this happen in real time in these series of clips. He thinks he's supposed to play along and laugh at the joke about his wife, so he does. He realizes that Chris Rock has hurt his wife's feeling by mocking a medical ailment that should be noted here, that she suffers from alopecia, so that is why her head is shaped bald. And then after he realizes that, he acts on that hurt by hurting Rock in response. He is essentially living his truth, right? That is what's going on here. After the attack, and I do think we should not sugarcoat that that's what this was. It's an act of physical violence intended to harm somebody and get them to stop doing something. Smith was consoled and counseled by Denzel Washington before giving a very emotional and pretty clearly improvised speech while accepting the Best Actor trophy for his performance in King Richard. There are lots of different angles to take here, but I guess the first and most important is this, Peter. Doesn't this whole kerfuffle make the joke earlier in the show about no one having seen The Last Duel, a movie about two men fighting with each other over their own status, then nominally about an insult to a woman, the true best picture of the year?
Well, certainly it's the biggest snub in the, you know, the best picture list and the most obvious one. It's a great movie. We all liked it. But it's a shockingly relevant movie for understanding the point, you know, what happened last night. And what happened last night was was in many ways a replay of what a sort of a modern day replay of what the Last Duel is about. And like you said, The Last Duel is about an honor culture in which two men end up fighting a literal duel to the death. You know, in theory, it's over the honor of a woman, but really it's about the preservation of their own status and their own power. And the woman's interests and role has essentially nothing to do with their battles between each other. And the movie takes pains throughout to point out that the woman is a bystander to all of this, and whatever it is that she wants, no one cares about it except for her. And so I don't know if that's exactly, maybe it's not exactly what happened last night, but it's certainly highly relevant as a metaphor for today's version of honor culture, which is just what we saw last night. And I think it's just like the movie is in typical Ridley Scott form. The movie is very down on honor culture and thinks that it has destructive consequences and that these masculine impulses that drive it are pretty awful. And I certainly think that what Will Smith did last night was completely inexcusable. It was wildly inappropriate. And even if you think that Chris Rock's joke was bad, was tasteless, was offensive, was something that had no place on stage at the Oscars, and I think that's debatable, and it's not even obvious to me that it was meant necessarily as an insult, given that the point of G.I. Jane is that Demi Moore's character, who shaves her head in the movie, is kind of awesome, right? And is able to compete with the men, and that like is able to do the same, right? It's sort of able to go through the same things that the men go through.
Let's not try and over. I think it's pretty clearly a jibe aimed at.
I think you can take it a bunch of different ways. And even if it's a jab, it doesn't matter. Violence in response to speech, even if offensive speech, even insults, even bad jokes, even inappropriate jokes, is just never appropriate. It isn't. And I don't think Will Smith should be like charged and hauled off to jail, but it's not okay what he did. It's just not in any way.
Alyssa, what did you make of last night's events?
I just found the whole thing so sad for everyone involved. And I understand the tendency to take something like this that's just genuinely shocking, right? I mean, we rarely see anything like this on television or in any other forum. And I understand the tendency to just take it and like load it up as grist for the mill, right? Like this is what our culture does. But, you know, beyond the question of, you know, whether Chris Rock was like being unfair to Jada Pinkett Smith. And like, that's barely a joke, right? It's like, you know, it doesn't even have setup. It's a reference to the zillion year old wannabe prestige Demi Moore movie. You know, it's just the whole thing becomes a mess for so many people, right? I mean, Smith does something just inexcusable on what should be the biggest night in his career. You know, I felt awful for Questlove, who is the person who gets an Oscar after all of this happens, right? I mean, he has been the musical director for the Oscar in previous years. He's been the onstage DJ. Like, he's literally been the, like, let's all make everybody feel good guy at the Oscars. And that's to go up there after this and be like, thanks, everybody. Can we have some sort of sense of normalcy again, right? Like, I feel terrible for Troy Kotsur and everyone else involved in CODA who, you know, again, had like this groundbreaking night. Like, they, you know, I mean, whatever you think of the movie, this kind of representation of deaf people is genuinely unusual. Kotsur is terrific in the movie. And they just get totally overshadowed in the last quarter of the show by this just awful thing hanging over it. You know, I feel bad for Jada Pinkett Smith, who, you know, whether or not she was particularly offended by this joke, and Rock, this is not the first time that Rock has, like, taken a shot at her from the Oscar stage. There's some history there. You know, Will Smith gets up on stage and gives this improvised speech and, like, doesn't talk about her, right? Like, it's like, I'm a protector. I'm a river for my people, right? And he doesn't talk about his wife at all. He literally talks about protecting the actresses in King Richard
who are clearly mortified. If you, I mean, the program cuts to them, to not to, to the actresses, but also to the Williams sisters, and they're just, they have no idea what to do.
Yeah, it's just horrible for everybody. And like, yeah, this is a moment about Oscar, about honor culture and disability and toxic masculinity and comedy and everything else. But it's also just like, it's just so awful and messy and personal and hurts so many people that I get the tendency to feed the takes mill. Like we all live in like the takes industrial economy, right? But just sitting with the personal awfulness of it for a moment and realizing the extent, like just how many factors are playing in here. Just, it just feels really bad. It just feels really bad.
I mean, I think it's,
and maybe that's sentimental of me, but it just feels really bad.
No, it's terrible. And it's also, it defeats the point of the Oscars in so many ways. I mean, Will Smith's slap ensured that this year's Oscars, you know, it's a show, an institution that is already struggling, that is supposed to be the face to the public of an art form that is also struggling right now. And Will Smith's slap ensured that this year's Oscars were absolutely in no way about any of the movies or any of the artists or any of the artistry that was supposed to be on display. The Oscars are supposed to be a celebration of a great popular art form. And instead, they became a literal slap fight.
Yeah.
I'll play devil's advocate here. And look, here's
oh, really,
what
Sonny?
Is
I'm surprised.
Here's you know what everybody has been talking about with regard to the Oscars for the last a couple years, really, is that the show itself is staid, it's dull, it's predictable. There's a reason audiences have been turning out, and it's not entirely because of the quality or popularity of the movies that have been picked. It's because the show itself is a little bit of a throwback, a little bit boring, and the whole rejiggering of the Oscars this year from the, like, we're going to reminisce about the 30th anniversary of White Men Can't Jump. We're going to have extreme sports people introduce the James Bond montage. We're going to have a Megan Thee Stallion remix of We Don't Talk About Bruno, right? The whole idea was to try and make this a must-watch thing. And there's a reason that the only thing anybody is talking about is the Will Smith thing. And it's not just because it was, you know, kind of a boring, predictable show. It's because it was an actual, unique, unpredictable event. The only sort of thing that can happen during a live performance. I mean, look, obviously you don't want people committing acts of physical violence at the Oscars every year, but isn't this sort of like actual flash of emotion and unpredictability exactly what the show needed?
No, because it's not fun.
I think that is. I'm sorry. I think that's actually absolutely wrong. I have not seen people have more fun with the Oscars than making sport of this. Now, say what you will about the show or about us as a culture, but that was like the Twitter where people watch the show and react to it live was having a great deal of fun with that.
Well, what else are you gonna? I think there's two ways you can react to it, which is just be like, to sigh in disgust and look away, or continue watching if you have to because it's your job to stay to the end, or you can start making jokes because it's Twitter and this is a bunch of celebrities, and in the end, you know, it's fair enough in some ways. Nobody really got deeply hurt, and Chris Rock acquitted himself incredibly well, and
pros pro
pros, I mean, pro. Just like if, like, yeah. That's one of the big takeaways here, is that Chris Rock is the most professional host you can possibly imagine. And
with the exception of making like a jackass remark about someone who's been a target of his before, right? Like, that's not actually professional. It wasn't, I mean, like, say
that's his job. That's the job of the host, is to.
No,
I don't know what you guys, I don't know when you guys showed up, but the very beginning of the show, we started with Beyonce, and then we went to a three host monologue that fell pretty flat. But then when Amy Schumer took over for the first hour, her opening monologue by herself was just roasting the stars and the movies. And and this is in fact what the presenters and the people who aren't winning the awards do with the Oscars is they roast the people who are involved, because these are big, beautiful, like big, rich, beautiful, famous people who ought to be able to take it and ought to be able to laugh at themselves to some extent. And yes, I think there are some that doesn't mean that any joke or any sort of remark is okay or appropriate. At the same time, it's not obvious to me that Chris Rock's joke there was wildly over the line. And I think that even if you think it's somewhat inappropriate, even if you think that, Will Smith's response could have been to yell. And if all Will Smith had done was sit there and yell exactly what he said, angrily and up and in an upset way, like, I think I might have totally sided with Will Smith, and maybe everybody else would have too. But the thing is, he literally did the, like, the joke on Twitter is, oh, you like post something that's like obviously a troll tweet, and you're just like, oh, this person chose violence.
Yeah.
No, Will Smith literally chose violence. And it's just totally wrong. And it doesn't matter. It actually doesn't matter what Chris Rock said. It's not relevant, because the whole point is that language, even insults, even wildly inappropriate insults, strings of them that are totally offensive and intentionally it's not okay to respond to them by hitting somebody.
Legally, I don't think that's actually true. There's a whole category of speech called fighting words that are not protected by the, but what are fighting words but insults? I mean,
there's a difference between.
You're saying there's nothing Chris Rock could have said up there that would have made it acceptable for Will Smith to go up there and slap him in the face. If he had done the Aristocrats about Jaden and Willow, you would have been like, oh, it's all in good fun. You
the
know?
Point
like,
of the I, Aristocrats I, is that comedians and comics should and can take things to the extremes verbally.
The point of being a father is you don't let somebody insult your children in the most vile way possible in front of 100 million people or whatever. Like,
it was 100 million saying, people, right?
Well, 13 million people. Yeah, whatever. Again, I'm fairly ambivalent about this. I'm much more open to the idea that Will Smith reacted perhaps inappropriately, but not insanely so, than either of you two. But I do think it's actually, like, just objectively wrong to say that there's nothing Chris Rock could have said that would not have made that would not be punchable. That's just wrong.
No, this is, to me, like, honor culture is bad, and it's bad because it says that you have to protect the honor and the dignity of your family or yourself because somebody else said words about them. And that's just wrong. That's a bad impulse. And it's one that we should say is wrong, even in what, you know, like, look like potentially sort of borderline cases where somebody said something that is kind of like, even if you think that it's kind of offensive, that it's kind of upsetting, that it's kind of inappropriate. Like, the whole point of civilized society is that you exercise self-restraint and that is correct and good. And, you know, for example, Chris Rock clearly had a joke teed up, if you watch the play-by-play, that he decided not to respond with. Instead, what he did was he took the aggression and he went on and did not respond in kind, because that is the correct and appropriate thing to do. Even though, like, if somebody comes up and slaps you, like, there's a self-defense argument that, like, you can respond physically or aggressively back, but no, actually you shouldn't. This is not the right way to comport yourself, man.
Yeah.
Like, also, you shouldn't be a jerk, but if your job is to get up there and make fun of movie stars, and then movie stars decide to hit you for it, this is the whole argument we've been having about comedy and about whether or not can make jokes that people find personally upsetting, perhaps even reasonably so, because they target, for example, physical conditions over which you have no control.
Right. So, well, this is
actually
the most.
Does that make comedians good when they do it? No, but it's then irrelevant if somebody strikes you.
Can I just back up for one second, because I feel like we have gone down. I mean, this conversation is a perfect example of the extent to which, like, this event is just like a quantum tree that lends itself to a million different interpretations and paths. But I think one nuance that is useful to understanding the response to this especially I think from Black women like Tiffany Haddish, who described this as like one of the most beautiful things she'd ever seen, is that, which is not a sentiment I share, is that I think there is a sense that Black women have been excluded from, not just from honor culture, but from the sort of expectations of common decency for a long time, and that Black men have been restrained from defending Black women because of stereotypes about Black male violence and everything else. And I think that, you know, it is interesting to see, you know, people I'm friends with have very different reactions to this than mine. Again, like my response is largely one of just sort of sadness and bafflement. And, you know, I have a friend with disabilities who, you know, is not someone I would have necessarily thought would have had this reaction, but tweeted about a time that her husband physically confronted someone who was giving her a hard time. You know, I've seen this sort of ambivalent reaction out there. And I think that part of the reason this has been such a sort of galvanizing moment is that it's not sort of functioning as the scissor, the concept that we've talked about sometimes here. It is, in fact, like, produced a bunch of sort of disparate, in some cases, surprising reactions and strange bedfellows. And it brings up a lot of stuff that is really painful and hard to sort out. And Sunny, I agree, like, this produced a lot of Twitter response, but a lot of that felt to me a lot more like nervous energy than like genuine fun or genuine joy. You know, if we're talking about what the Oscars are supposed to accomplish, you know, if they are supposed to be a celebration of movies, and if they're also supposed to be galvanizing in a sort of positive and energetic way, this moment accomplished neither one of those things. And so whatever you think of it as morality or marriage, I think it, even by that standard, it's bad television.
I think that's 100% true. I mean, nobody's talking about the Oscars for the movies, and that's a shame.
Yeah.
Even though I don't know how many people would have been talking about a CODA win anyway, since again 4% of the population, I believe, has seen CODA, which is you know, it's not a huge movie, and it probably will never be now because everybody's talking about something else. I want to move on from this, but I do think it is just worth asking for formality's sake whether or not this is a controversy or a non-controversy. So, is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Will Smith open hand slapped Chris Rock right in the mouth for talking about his wife in a derogatory manner? Peter.
Can't think of a more obvious controversy.
Alyssa.
Controversy.
It's pretty clearly a controversy. Will Smith, don't go around slapping people. And I think we need to, we haven't talked about Denzel's role as a peacemaker here. Maybe we'll do that at a later date. But
he,
you know, Denzel Washington,
clearly a wise man,
the most grown up person in Hollywood. So kudos to Denzel. On this Friday's bonus episode at atma.thebulwark.com, we're going to talk about the Oscars a little bit more. Different topic, though. A topic that was almost as controversial as the Will Smith slap heard around the world. But that was Sean Combs's Puff Daddy, Diddy, whatever you want to call him, his weird introduction of The Godfather, which is celebrating 50 years of existence this year at the Oscars. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about The Godfather just in general and kind of what we think about that movie as well, and how much you know, it means to us as people who value things like family and loyalty, which are the, you know, the clear thematic through lines, the importance of family and loyalty.
Speak for yourself, Sonny.
All right, now on to the main event, The Lost City. The Lost City is a throwback of sorts. It's a star-driven piece of original entertainment that relies on the charisma and chemistry of its leads, in this case, Sandra Bullock, who is playing romance novelist Loretta Sage, and Channing Tatum, who is playing male model Alan Caprison, maybe Caprison. I'm not sure exactly how that's supposed to be pronounced, to keep us entertained for 2 hours. Loretta is tired of writing her romance novels, in part because she's tired of having to hang around with the hunky but brainless Alan, who has come to think of himself as an equal partner in the series, thanks to his Fabio-style cover poses. As the final books tour kicks off, Loretta is kidnapped by pint-sized would-be media mogul Abigail Fairfax, who's played by Daniel Radcliffe. And he hopes that her skills will help him track down a priceless artifact in an island off in the Atlantic Ocean. Alan, meanwhile, enlists the help of rescue expert Jack Traynor, played by Brad Pitt, to recover the writer. The plot of this movie is almost beside the point, right? It's a serviceable romancing the stone type movie, and there's not much more to it than that. It either works or it doesn't based on how much you enjoy seeing Bullock, Tatum, and Pitt together on screen. I happen to like it quite a bit, enough to overlook some of the terrible ADR jokes that are inserted into the film in post-production, some of the shoddy CGI backgrounds, the mediocre action choreography. This movie is by no means high art, but it is a sort of picture that more or less has to succeed in theaters if theaters are going to have a future, apart from being like, you know, the place where you go see a comic book movie every once in a while. Date night movies matter. We can't forget that. As an aside, I'd like to note that my favorite performance in the film might well have been Radcliffe's. We hear a lot about how good and how interesting the work that like Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson have done post Twilight. But I think we should hear more about Daniel Radcliffe, whose work in films like Guns Akimbo, where he plays an internet troll who gets guns nailed to his hand and is forced to fight to the death for the cheering online masses, or Swiss Army Man, where he plays a farting corpse. Those movies matter too, and I think he's doing pretty good work there, and I think he's doing very good work here as the saucy, like not quite, you know, Murdoch air in this movie. He provides just the right level of unhinged spice to keep things interesting. Alyssa, what did you make of The Lost City?
So I don't think that The Lost City is necessarily terribly good, but I really enjoyed myself at it. And part of the thing that I wanted to talk about today is that it's an excellent showcase for what makes both Bullock and Tatum so appealing as actors. There are a lot of things I could say about Sandra Bullock, whose work I adore. You know, she's one of the last, as a lot of people have noted, just one of the last real butts in seats movie stars. And as I was watching her early in the movie, there's a sort of close-up shot in her face, and I realized that she has never gotten her bottom teeth fixed in the way that you would necessarily see, like, a starlet today just be sort of mandatory for them. And she is, even though, you know, Bullock is unbelievably gorgeous, she's in her 50s in this movie, which is just like sort of incomprehensible to me. The idea that I've been watching Sandra Bullock movies like basically my entire movie watching life, and she is, you know, she's been allowed to be a sort of viable romantic heroine in all of them, is amazing. But she also comes across as convincingly regular. And I think a key to that in a lot of her best movies is the sense of melancholy that she plays here. One of the first movies that I, you know, the first sort of grown-up movies I watched when I was a kid and that I really loved was her romantic comedy, While You Were Sleeping, where she plays an orphaned, a token taker on the L in Chicago, who has developed this sort of fantasy crush on a lawyer played by Peter Gallagher. And when he falls onto the tracks, she rescues him and just sort of blurts out that she's his fiance, so she'll be able to stay with him in the hospital. And the movie is partially about the sort of unraveling of that lie. She falls in love with the lawyer's brother, played by Bill Pullman. But it's also about her finding a family and not wanting to let it go. I mean, it's a very sad movie in a lot of ways. It's not a dark movie, but it's very much a movie about being lonely. And she does a really beautiful job portraying that. And she does it sort of again here, right? Where she, you know, she is someone who is in mourning, and it's a movie about letting that go. She also is just extremely good at playing sort of physical awkwardness or uncomfortableness. And so the jumpsuit, that's the sort of recurrent joke in this movie. Sandra Bullock wears stuff that looks sort of like that as part of her job as an actress, right? Like she wears like glitzy, fancy stuff and high heels all the time. And yet both here and in Miss Congeniality, she manages to just make herself look incredibly uncomfortable in her own skin in a way that makes her, you know, relatable, even though she is nothing like, you know, those women watching her movies at home or in theaters. And in fact, this movie and others she's in don't even really try and ugly her up, right? They just rely on her ability to play uncomfortable in her own skin. In the same way, Tatum, who is very good looking, very built, literally to the point that like he's starring in a three movie franchise about his own past as a stripper, he's very good at playing characters who are kind of goofy and weird, right? And, you know, Alan here is like a little bit of a physical coward. He is, you know, he goes to like meditation retreats. He's kind of like dorky and awkward. And, you know, he was sort of the same way in the 21 Jump Street movies, where he plays like a former jock who goes back to high school and discovers he actually really likes hanging out with nerds and, you know, is sort of reliant on the friendship of this person that he bullied in the past. And so, you know, beyond the question of whether this movie looks good, which I think it doesn't, beyond the question of whether the plot hangs together, eh. Yeah, it's just it is a nice showcase for a kind of unusual set of talents possessed by two people who are just very appealing and are appealing both because they're just stunningly physically attractive, but because of the ways that they make their characters seem real.
Yeah, I mean that's kind of the key here, right? Is that it is pleasurable to watch attractive people do things on screen, but it can also be alienating. And the thing that they manage to do very well is to make themselves seem both like physically very attractive, but also like kind of relatable, like drinking the wine in the tub with the ice and the Chardonnay, right? Like, I've never done that, but I can imagine it would be a comforting thing.
Manhattan in the shower, right?
Well, exactly. I mean, I Coors Light probably, but yeah, same basic idea.
Like
but
Ben Affleck in the Sad Dad basketball movie.
Exactly. Or like, you know, Channing Tatum being like very, very attractive and like talking to a random kitchen guy about how he can't get, you know, the interest of the woman he's interested in. As a stunningly beautiful person myself, who has nevertheless had trouble, you know, sometimes connecting with women who I love, you know, it's very relatable. I like that. Peter, what did you make of The Lost City?
It's a textbook mediocre date movie. Competent, I guess, in that it makes no obvious mistakes in most ways. I think it's just good enough to work for what it's trying to do. But there's no real sparks of genius or even real cleverness here outside of the performances themselves. And I think, you know, I think the two main performances are obviously really strong, just in the sense that Bullock and Tatum are super appealing. And they are performers who, even in material that I find pretty blah, I like watching them on screen and I like the way they engage with each other. And it's, you called it relatable. I would just say that it's very open. It's inviting to the audience. And they seem to not be performing for themselves or for each other so much as trying to bring people into what they're doing. And so the stars completely carry this movie. I will comment on Radcliffe in a moment because I think you're totally wrong there.
Wow. But, how dare you?
This movie... I didn't love this movie, and it's not the kind of thing that I would really want to see, except for the fact that I sometimes like to go see this sort of movie with people who like it, and because it's useful to see as an like just as a measure of where Hollywood is at in terms of big star pictures. It looks like garbage. It's not just that some of the background CG shots aren't great. It's that this is a movie that takes place, that is set almost entirely outside, and yet very clearly, almost none of it was filmed under sky. It was filmed on sound stages and or in front of green screen with terrible CG backgrounds. And so here is a movie that is supposed to look like an adventure film in which big stars have gone to someplace that looks interesting. And it just looks like a bunch of plastic rocks and plants in like a barely better than Star Trek The Next Generation planet set. It's awful to look at in a way that really, really bugged me. It's also weirdly defensive. And this, I think, is the most interesting thing about this movie, is that it offers an in-text defense of the kind of movie that it is. Because Sandra Bullock's character, of course, is a novelist of what she refers to, I believe the term she uses is schlock. And it's romantic adventure stories that the movie makes a point to note at the beginning are the like what carry the publishing industry. And this is true, by the way, even though it's not reflected in the New York Times, you know, bestseller list for fiction. The publishing industry is like a romance house that has a whole bunch of little, you know, literary outlets attached to it. It's all romance fiction, because that is what gets read and bought. And it's women readers buying romance is what carries the publishing industry. And so the movie offers a kind of, like, she looks down on the work that she is producing. And Channing Tatum is like, but people like this stuff, and it gives them a brief escape and some hope and some happiness. And there's this whole conversation in which the movie is basically, it's like sort of filtered through a defense of romance novels, but it's actually a defense of mediocre date movies, the kind of movie that you are watching.
I think the actual literal line here is, I wrote it down because this jumped out at me as well, Peter. It was, don't minimize the people who love what you write by calling it schlock.
Yeah.
The obvious connection here being like, don't run down a nice little movie like this by calling it, you know, disposable. People need disposable things, but that's true. That's true.
It's a defense of the type of movie that it is. And it's also, in that defense, a kind of acknowledgement that Hollywood doesn't make movies like this very often anymore. And that, to me, was kind of interesting, that the movie, that like this movie is coming out and saying, gosh, this is the kind of movie we used to make all the time. We used to make Sandra Bullock movies that were original premises, though quite structurally formulaic, in which the enjoyment was seeing Sandra Bullock, who is always enjoyable to watch, along with a male star who is hopefully also enjoyable to watch, involved in some shenanigans and hijinks that you will hopefully find pleasurable for 2 hours. I think this movie's biggest failure is actually the Daniel Radcliffe character. He does a fine job, but his character doesn't make any sense, is totally undeveloped. It's ridiculous, and it could have been both, like, on the one hand, more ridiculous and more funny, or it could have been something that was a little bit smarter and made a little more sense. And it chose instead to be as generic as possible just to keep the plot engine moving along so that Bullock and Tatum could do their thing.
They should have swapped him with Antonio Banderas' character from Uncharted.
That's exactly right. And Banderas would have been a better foil for them. Again, I don't think Radcliffe is the problem here. I think it's the writing, and I think it's the character that Radcliffe just couldn't. He tries to make something of this character, and it's just nothing there.
I'm sorry. I strongly disagree with this take. I strongly disagree with this take because, like, you're right that it's a nothing character, but Radcliffe definitely makes the most of it. Like, when there's this moment where he, like, has this kind of impish look on his face as he's saying coital reverie in his, like, British accent that just made me laugh out loud in the theater. It was so absurd and so, like, he has his own sort of star power. I mean, I talked about this in my review, but it's worth noting that Daniel Radcliffe actually has the highest box office totals of anybody in this movie. In a very technical sort of way, he's actually the biggest star in this film. Now, that stardom is all derived from his performances in the Harry Potter movies. And you could argue, well, is he really the star? Is Harry Potter the star? Is the character the star? But, like, he brings his own kind of star persona to this movie. And the idea of having Harry Potter say things like coital reverie with a, like, impish grin on his face is its own kind of meta comment and is in itself very, very funny.
I'm impressed by his commitment to the beard.
We should also note how funny Brad Pitt's cameo is in this. Like, it's a sort of, like, sleazy, enlightened, like, hostage rescuer guy, like, out-handsoming and out-charming Channing Tatum. That's just very funny and well done.
So Brad Pitt, I said there was nothing particularly clever about this movie. The Brad Pitt sequence is the cleverest bit in the movie. And I think the problem with this movie is that Brad Pitt actually should have been the villain. Because Brad Pitt turning at the act, instead of getting killed at the act break, if he had become the villain and become, right, because he's the antithesis of the Channing Tatum character, and he's like the thing that Bullock and Tatum are in some ways aligned against, which is the real life vision of the fantasy that she sells.
Yeah.
While he's on screen, he's a great quasi-antagonist, because he's alluring to Bullock, right? You know, and he's driving Channing Tatum mad. And that's a great conflict that the movie just dumps 30 minutes into the 2 hours. Yeah. And again, it's a great gag that they kill off Brad Pitt's character, right? And, like, you sort of...
Kind of, though. The cheap having him come back in the mid-credits scene.
Because they clearly recognize that he's great in the movie.
Right.
But he would have been a much better main villain, I think his character works better than Daniel Radcliffe's character. And I think it's also thematically more interesting to see them square off against somebody who in some ways represents the thing that they are selling to readers and kind of dislike, and to see what it's actually like in real life.
Yeah.
It would have been a challenge to their worldviews in an interesting way that Radcliffe's character offered no challenge to who Bullock and Tatum actually were as people.
It's also just a really, just in the same sense that this movie is sort of meta-commentary on its own genre, Pitt's performance is a great commentary on his own former heartthrob status, right? I mean, he's back, he's like straight up back in like the Legends of the Fall and Interview with a Vampire hair and everything. It's just, it's a hoot.
So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Lost City? Peter?
Thumbs down.
Alyssa?
Thumbs up. Peter?
Thumbs up.
You enjoy, man. I don't know.
Why does Peter hate joy? That's next week's controversies and controversies. But that is it for this week's show. If you loved it, make sure to check out our members-only bonus episode coming Friday to atma.thebulwark.com on the meaning of The Godfather at age 50. And make sure to tell your friends about the show. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If you don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sunny Bunch. Had a few folks complain to me on Twitter at Sunny Bunch from the YA fiction world last year. We'll see if they stuck around for this episode. I doubt they did. But I will convince you, as long as you're not from YA Twitter, that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.